prelude to our interview today with Dr. Catherine Albrecht, I would like to encourage you to go to technocracy.news, take a look around for sure, see some of the latest stories and stuff that relate to technocracy. You'll be interested, I believe. Get on the mailing list, too, so you get a daily digest delivered to your mailbox every morning with the latest postings. I would also like to encourage you to buy a copy of Technocracy Rising, The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. This is my book that is the A to Z book on technocracy and how it applies to today's world. If you want to really connect the dots to everything that's going on in the world today, this is the book you need to read. It makes a great book as a gift for this Christmas. And I might also say, how about giving some Christmas gifts to people like your mayor and people on the city council? How about the board of supervisors at your county? How about some of the board members of your school board? You get the idea. The books are inexpensive. There's a graduated discount available on technocracy.news for the book. The more books you buy, the cheaper the price gets. If you get up, I think, to 50 books, the price goes down to under $10 a copy. So take a look at that. Consider what you might do for this Christmas and how you might spread the information in this book around. We're speaking today with Dr. Catherine Albrecht, who is the author of the book Spy Chips and is very knowledgeable in all the area that has to do with a total surveillance society. And we're going to be discussing some of these things today. It's kind of an exciting science fiction-like look into what's happening in our country with technology that's being used for surveillance. And we've got several headlines up on technocracy.news under the category of total surveillance society. And it would be great to get Catherine's view on some of these things because she lives this all day long, all the time. And well, one of the headlines we had up, Catherine, and welcome, Catherine, to the program. I really appreciate
your
spending the time.
It's great to be with you.
One of the things that that we've been talking about is that Vizio, the TV maker, which is very popular. Every time you go into Costco, man, they got these. I think they're up to like 65 inches now or something. It's incredible theater that you can take into your home. But Vizio is making smart TVs now that that actually tracks viewers' watching habits. And of course, the manufacturing companies, the marketing companies are very, very interested in this technology to fine-tune their marketing pitch to people. But it's just been recently revealed that the smart TV is able to actually communicate with your cell phone in the same room. People would never put this together by themselves. But if a tone is issued from a TV that's inaudible to you, that the cell phone can hear, the cell phone can pick up on that tone, and all of a sudden, your cell phone is related to your TV. And this gives the marketers incredible intelligence on how to market to you. Is there a threat, do you think, even if it was just limited to marketing, is there a threat with the government getting involved in this kind of technology?
Yeah, you know, what's happening now is that I like to use the word smart and warn people against the word smart, because smart sounds like a wonderful thing. Oh, intelligent and good, and, you know, it's wise and doing smart things. But the word smart, I think the best piece of advice I can give listeners with regard to this word is smart means surveillance. Smart means that the smartness belongs to somebody else with regard to you. It doesn't mean you become smarter. It means that whoever is controlling the other end of that smart device is using it so that they can gain intelligence about you. And, you know, in the same way that intelligence agencies on behalf of the government, like the NSA or the CIA or the FBI or other intelligence agencies, are all about spying on and gaining and gathering intelligence about their targets, these smart devices are really about gathering and gaining intelligence on us. And so anytime you hear the word smart in front of anything, whether it's a smart TV, a smart alarm clock, a smart toaster, a smart washer and dryer, a smart thermostat, you need to immediately have all the have all your hackles go up and be on full alert, because what it means is that that particular appliance or device is capable of communicating information about you to third parties. And in the case of smart TVs, they're part of this new move towards the smart home, which is part of the Internet of Things. And I've been warning people about this for over 10 years. In fact, I'm just celebrating the 10th anniversary of our best-selling book, Spy Chips, which gives people the full overview of what's going on with RFID technology, the Internet of Things, the imbuing of things with a form of sentience, with a form of surveillance capacity, so that the very things in your environment that you actually pay good money for and that are supposed to be your servants become your jailers and begin actually watching you. So the idea of the connected home of the future, the Internet of Things, is that all physical items in your home will actually have a communication channel set up to the Internet. And so everything from your coffee cup to your cutting board to your sink to your refrigerator to your recycling bin will all be communicating information in real time about your activities in your own home. And that information will be going into the hands of all sorts of folks. And the best way to understand this is to take a look at a patent for the smart home of the future taken out by one of the most powerful technology companies on Earth, and that's Google. And what Google did in describing, because I love patents because they usually don't get run past the marketing department of companies. They're usually the engineering people, and they don't bother putting on their, oh my gosh, this isn't going to look good to the public hat. They just put on their, we better patent this before somebody else comes up with it hat. And so they reveal really nasty plans in these patents and in very cold, unvarnished reality of what they plan to do. And so in this smart home of the future, Google actually talks about having a home where there is literally no place that you can go inside the home that you will not be surveilled, that you will not be on video surveillance and monitored in some way. And they say that this is really great for a security perspective because then no one can break into your home and hide because there will be no places to hide, that even the end of that hallway or the corner of your basement or any place that you might try to go to get out of range of the surveillance will be watched. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about smart TVs, this is really, I think, one of the very first volleys of putting this stuff into our homes. And I've said for years that it's bad enough that over the last 20, 30 years, we've seen surveillance cameras going up in public spaces. We go into the bank, we go into the store, we go walking down the street, we drive our cars through intersections that are watching us outside of our homes. And then the second wave of that was these devices that we carry, these smartphones. And again, the word smart should tip you off to the fact that they're watching you. So now people are carrying these things around. And there's a whole lot of surveillance of people happening in public spaces and on the Internet. But the one place we've always been safe, the one place we've always had a refuge from this, is in our own homes. When we go in a house and we close the door and we draw the blinds, we're in a private space that no one else can observe what we're doing. And I have a doctorate in psychology, human development and psychology from Harvard University. And one of the things that is absolutely essential for just your psychological, mental, and emotional well-being is to have a space where you can just let your hair down. We humans are very social creatures. We're very aware of what other people think about us, and for the most part, that's a good thing when we're interacting with other people. But in order to keep up the amount of effort that that requires, we've got to have a place to sort of reset our batteries, to kind of go back to reset our sense of self, and we do that in our home. This is why in your home, if you want to sing at the top of your lungs in the shower, you ought to be able to do that. If you want to mop your kitchen, you know, wearing a Superman cape, it's nobody else's business if you do. There's such a thing as just having a private space. And so what all of these marketers and government officials and other intelligence-gathering beings want to do is they're very frustrated that they actually can't get into your home and they can't actually watch what you're doing when you're in your own private space. And we know this from Ed Snowden, a really wonderful book, if people want to get a copy of this book, by Glenn Greenwald, the UK Guardian reporter that first broke the Ed Snowden story. He wrote an absolutely eye-opening, extraordinary book called No Place to Hide. And it talks about, people have a little bit of a sense of what Ed Snowden figured out, but when you read this book, you will be page after page just wanting to call up your friends and yell at your spouse and say, look, whoa, oh my gosh, it's worse than I thought. The book is that level of amazing. And in the book, he talks about a pervasive mindset on the part of the NSA that it's kind of like sharks smelling blood. Once you know, if you cut yourself in the water and there are sharks around, they'll go, oh, that's tasty, I'm going to get the whole thing. And the NSA really has that going on, is that they've tasted a bit of our information, and now they want the whole thing. They want to just gobble us up whole. And they're very frustrated by any places that they consider blind spots where they're not able to know everything. And our Constitution, the Fourth Amendment to the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, actually protects us against this, if people would actually apply it. And it says that they don't have the right to go rifling around in our personal affairs, but the NSA believes that it does. And so, again, this kind of blind spot of your home is extraordinarily appealing to these intelligence-gathering folks. So if they can find a way with this home of the future to put appliances in your home that monitor you and report back, Google does a really good job in their patent of explaining who they would share this information with. And what I love about this patent is that they make it very clear it's not about you. You don't derive much benefit from this. I'm sure once they commercialize it, they'll come up with all kinds of reasons why you need it. But they really say this is going to be great because it's going to allow law enforcement to have access to what happens inside your home. It will allow marketers and companies to know what's going on so they can market more products to you based on what's going on inside your home. They're going to share this information with university researchers because it would be very interesting to them to have you kind of be rats in a cage in your own home so they can watch you and perform experiments on you and see how you respond in your own home. And so they have this whole list of other people that the smart items in the home will be using the internet to communicate with. So this vision, and I'll just give you a couple of examples of how horrifying it is, and then we can go back to the TV. So Google actually envisions a smart alarm clock that would sit next to your bed. And the smart alarm clock would be equipped with all sorts of sensors, and it would listen to your breathing, and thus also, of course, listen to your conversations and your pillow talk with your spouse or anything else that happens in that zone. And it would figure out what time you went to bed. It would help you, quote unquote, by figuring, oh, you didn't get to bed till 1 o'clock in the morning, but you've got an appointment at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. So I better remind you or maybe make a modification to your calendar. So the clock is actually listening to you breathe. It knows if you have insomnia because your breathing pattern changes when you're awake. It's watching, listening to, and knowing all about you. And then it even says if you fall asleep somewhere else, that the home will know that too. So let's say you fall asleep on the sofa watching the TV. Then there will be sensors in that area that will figure out what time you went to sleep and how was your breathing and how is your sleep. So this is just one example of this whole horrific, nightmarish sort of Orwellian vision of this home where you cannot escape the smart surveillance, the smart devices that are surveilling you no matter what you do.
I think so the book, book 1984, the hero had an opportunity to slip around a corner in his little apartment and where he could avoid the camera. But what you're saying is that there is literally no escape from this total surveillance issue.
And Glenn Greenwald's book, of course, titled No Place to Hide, is so appropriate for this because that's really the idea. And in fact, Google is really, I'll see if I can get you a link to this patent so people can take a look at it. I've actually done a write-up on it. And what is particularly interesting to me is that obviously Google stands to make a huge amount of money. Google, I want to talk about them in a bit, but Google makes its money by knowing things about people. That's how their search engine makes money. They're not in the business of telling you the answers to all your questions. They're not your mom. They're not God. They although they'd like to be, they actually make money by providing you with a window where you periodically come along and deposit useful marketing information to them in the form of questions. And so that's how they figured out how to become a multi-billion dollar corporation, one of the most powerful companies on planet Earth, is by retrieving that information and figuring out ways to entice you or lure you with bait so that you'll deposit even more information. And so they would love to be able to go beyond simply being able to look at all your searches and know who cuts your hair, because after all, who uses the phone book nowadays? You look it up online. Or knowing what you cooked for dinner last night because you needed the recipe for lamb chops and you Googled it, looked it up on Google. They want to go beyond that, and they've already gone beyond that since 2004 with Gmail, which was invented specifically for the purpose of reading your email, because it would have been illegal for them to hack into everybody's email, which back in 2004 was private. So they created an enticing new bait called email with lots of storage and lots of snazzy features in the form of Gmail, and then they got people to go and deposit all of their email into their clutches as well. So now they can read what you write to your friends and who your friends are, how often you write to them, who your babysitter is, if you sent directions or where you're going on vacation. If you attach your tax return in an email to your accountant, they open it and they know what your income is and your social security number and your kids' names and your deductions, literally everything. If you could actually see the amount of information that Google has collected on the average internet user, it would be like the old Encyclopedia Britannicas that took up two shelves in the library from A to Z. That's how many pages it would take to print out the amount of information that Google has on the average American. So if that's the amount of information they can glean simply from our online activities, imagine what would happen if they could glean that kind of information from your offline activities when you really think it's private, because it was a real coup for them to create Gmail and give themselves inside access to everybody's email, and still 10 years later, 12 years later, nobody's figured out that they're doing it. So talk about brilliant. They want to do the same thing in your home, the same way that they're now reading all of your email, which is the sole reason why they offer you that service. They want to be able to listen to all your conversations at the dinner table. They want to be able to know what time you went to bed. They want to be able to know what products you took off the shelf in your kitchen or in your bathroom, everything. So this notion of smartness is really the tentacles of this global brain, which is really Google and Apple and these big technology companies combined with government. It's a global brain that's being created, and it wants to reach its tentacles, extend its reach, its surveillance reach. Imagine tentacles, and instead of suckers, it has little cameras on the end of all, you know, down there dangling around. And it wants to reach that into the most private areas of your life, into your car, into your house, your bedroom, your shower, your kitchen. And ultimately, it wants to reach those tentacles literally inside of you. So this global thing that we are building is, I believe, going to be the biggest enemy that humanity has ever faced, because once we add artificial intelligence into this, this thing is going to go way beyond our control, and it's going to have literally total control over everyone and over even their physiological function to where you can't escape it.
Yeah, I have said for some time that the technocrats among us have learned how to collect data in ways that we never dreamed, whether it be emails or phone calls or commercially available information scraped off of social media, whatever. They've gotten very good at collecting stuff and getting it stored onto these massive disk arrays that they've created now, like in the Utah data center that the NSA operates. But the analysis technology has lagged behind by at least, probably, this is my opinion, probably 3 to 5 years. In other words, they don't yet have the ability to analyze this incredible amount of data on a real-time basis yet, but they're working at breakneck speed to where one day, and soon, the analysis technology is going to catch up with the storage technology. And then we're going to begin to see things that we never dreamed possible.
That's right.
In terms of how they will determine what our future behavior will be. And we've even seen some of this. I think Florida was the first one to implement a pre-crime, if you will, predictive policing It's just like, you know, based on a psychographic profile of people, who's most likely to commit a crime? Well, this is what the Tom Cruise movie was about, Minority Report, I think it was, 2002? Pretty scary movie. But this is actually where we're headed with this. Once they get the analysis programs in place, not only the computing power, but also the artificial intelligence to tie it together, we'll see things happen in orders of magnitude almost every year after that, I think.
I agree completely. And even with what they have right now, it's pretty impressive. Because if we go back to our example of the Encyclopedia Britannica, when I was a kid, we actually had a Funkin' Wagnalls encyclopedia. And I never read every single entry from A to Z. There's no way that I would have been able to do that. But when I wanted to know about the Panama Canal, I could just take the P volume off the shelf and open to that page, and there were 5 pages of information and pictures. And that's really all I needed. So with the storage capacity, which is really almost becoming unlimited these days to store this kind of information about people, it's not the case currently that all of it is being analyzed in real time as it's collected. But what is the case is that once someone becomes a person of interest, whether it's because they're being marketed to or perhaps because they've expressed some views about the government or perhaps a political party or perhaps a political viewpoint, kind of like the Tea Party being discriminated against by the IRS, once they've come on the radar screen, at that point they become the Panama Canal. Then you can simply open up all of the archives of massive amounts of bulging information and drill down to that particular individual or group's information. And that's when this information becomes so incredibly dangerous, because it's all there for the taking. So getting back to the TV example and this idea of an almost sentient entity being built that wants to extend its tentacles into our lives, the TV is one way in which it's actually doing that. The first TV that we heard about doing this was the Sanyo television, and I actually do a daily radio program at KMAshow.com, and I actually had the reporter who first reported on that story way back when on my show right away to talk about his discovery. And what he discovered is that he had actually purchased a brand new Sanyo smart TV without really knowing it was smart. He didn't really pay attention to that. And he installs this big screen TV on his wall, and it doesn't come with a manual nowadays. It comes with, you know, like some quick installation instructions, but the manual itself is actually located in the computer on the TV. So in order to read the terms and conditions, you know how you agree and you sign on and you do all these things, he had to flip through over 45 pages of information on the screen of the TV. And so he's clicking next and next and next. And most people, I would imagine, you know, the vast majority, if not everybody, would say, oh, forget it, I'm not going to read all this dumb stuff on my TV. But because he was a reporter, he actually went through every screen and he read every screen. And when he got to a page in the 40s, he saw the fine print that said, if you are using this television and having private conversations in the television, please be aware that those televisions can be that those conversations will be transmitted through the television to third parties. And so he's reading this and going, what? What are you talking about? And he comes to understand that the television actually has a two-way viewing microphone sensor in it. So not only are you watching the TV, but the TV is actually watching you. And not only are you listening to the speakers, but it actually has a microphone that's listening to you. And the reason Sanyo put this capacity in the television was to make the television, quote, smart. So you could say to the television, you could actually talk to it and say, TV, record, Game of Thrones at 9 p.m. on Tuesday. And the TV would say, you know, yes, sir, master, sir, I will do that. So that was the idea, is that the TV would be listening to you, so you wouldn't have to go through all the bother of trying to figure out how to get it, you know, programmed. We all know those are hard to do. And the idea is that the TV would listen. Unfortunately, what it also meant is that the TV was listening to everything else you said on the off chance that you might be issuing it a direct command. So this TV was listening to people. And what I found so fascinating about this is here I have this guy on my show, and he broke the story, and it's become now, they've got a law in California, which is on the governor's desk to be signed, to actually make these televisions have to report to you and have to have this capability be turned off, and you have to say it actually on the packaging so you don't accidentally bring this thing home. So it's become a big deal, but here's the telling part. At the end of my interview with him, and he was on my program for an hour, I said, well, you know, thanks for letting us all know about this. This is really terrible. And what did they say when you returned the TV? And you know what he said to me? I never returned the TV. And I thought, what? You kept the TV? He said, yeah, I just, flipped a couple of settings to turn it off. And this is really important because I'm all about solutions these days, not just telling you about the problem. His response was a solution in that he told us all about it, but it really wasn't the ultimate solution, which is to make a change in your purchasing behavior, to make a change in the marketplace, because Sanyo doesn't care if 10,000 or a million stories are published on the internet saying they're really bad. As long as those stories say their name and spell it right and people buy the TV, they laugh all the way to the bank. Sanyo is only interested in whether or not you are spending money for their product. And so for this guy to write all of these stories and have all this report floating around, but then allow them to keep his $1,000, doesn't send a message to Sanyo of, hey, you better knock this activity off. The only way you're going to send a message to these corporations to stop is either by doing what California is doing and passing a law against it, or I think more effectively, because I'm a libertarian, saying, I'm not going to participate. I don't want this TV, and I would have loved to have seen at that point 1,000 people buy that TV and 3 days later go and return it and let them figure out how to deal with all the cardboard boxes and plastic that's missing and used TVs that they now have to take back. And that would send a message to them, ooh, it costs us money to be doing these evil things, so we better knock it off.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, some of this technology was patently illegal in the United States a few years ago. And in many cases, when the government has been caught spying, for instance, in areas that they shouldn't be spying in, they've been slapped down by either a court, perhaps, or by Congress itself. And what's happened, though, looking back, we see these little points of conflict. But we look back over the last 10 years, and we find that basically they just ignored all of the little slaps along the way and went ahead and did what they wanted to do anyway, even if it was illegal. And in some cases, where they couldn't get away with it locally, they exported the technology to places like China, where nothing is illegal in China. And they developed the technology in China using, you know, their own citizens. And then when the technology is proven out, we find it creeping back into the United States.
Right.
This is absolutely amazing. I was interested in a story back in late October where China announced that it's building a huge citizens database to track dissenters.
Yes.
They don't hold anything back. They just say, well, this is to track dissenters. And so they're collecting all the information like they are here. And they're talking about using all this information to assign a score, kind of like a credit score to assign a score to every citizen in society.
A loyalty score, yeah.
Where you'll be analyzed, and then you'll get this score as to whether you're a team player or not. And that will be linked to your national identity card. So,
right.
You know, if you walk up to a checkpoint and you find out, well, your score is only 350, where, you know, a good little citizen comrade, his score ought to be up around 800. Well, okay, you're a troublemaker, right? Oh boy, step over here, sir. You're going to go through another line, and you won't like this one. This use of technology that we're talking about today. I am absolutely convinced in my mind, looking back, that there was a time where this would have completely freaked out, if not creeped out, everybody in society, including Congress, including the judges, including everybody. But it's just like the frog has been put in the water, and incrementally that water's been increased in temperature. And now all of a sudden we can't get loose from it. It's everywhere, pervasive. We can't get loose from it. seems to me to just be insanity, but
yeah. So I think it's important that we recognize that these technologies going into our homes are actually recent. The encroachment onto our internet privacy and the encroachment in our public spaces has pretty much crept up on us over the last 20, 30 years. But this we are living in a window in time when we actually have the ability to point out and stop the encroachment into our homes. And what's really interesting, you talked about 1984 and Winston and Big Brother, you know, watching him through the telescreen, which is very much like these TVs we're talking about. But he could escape, and under Google, there's not a plan for that. What's interesting to me, I actually do this work because I have a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf 4 feet wide of 20th century history. And in the 20th century, people's own governments were 6 times more deadly than all of the century's wars combined. And if you stop and think about that statistic for a moment, it's shocking, it's horrifying, it's mortifying. And we're talking about tens of millions of people killed under Mao Zedong, under Stalin, under Hitler, under Pol Pot in Cambodia. We have a very bad history as human beings of being able to put leaders in power and give them enormous amounts of power and have them treat the citizenry right, and they typically tend not to do that. So one of the concerns that I have about these new technologies is that we're giving unprecedented amounts of power. And especially when we start talking about Paris attacks and we start talking about, you know, school shootings or whatever it might be, always the clamor is give us more power, give us more surveillance capacity, give us more ability to watch you. But what I think is particularly interesting is in the 20th century that the surveillance tyranny was exactly that. It was overt. When Stalin wanted to listen to the citizenry, when in the Soviet Union they took over countries and then wanted to know who was grumbling about it, they used a whole network of spies. The KGB used a whole network of spies. The Stasi in East Germany used a whole network of spies. They opened mail. They listened to phone calls. They sent spies to your kid's birthday party to hear if anybody said something disloyal. But and people knew that if they did speak up or if they did oppose the government, that they would basically be disappeared in the middle of the night and jackbooted thugs would come and kill them. What's happening in the 21st century is a very different form of tyranny. 21st century tyranny comes with a smile and a fistful of coupons. 21st century tyranny is based not on imposing something on the public at gunpoint, but finding psychological methods of manipulating people into choosing the surveillance devices themselves. So, you know, if you think about it, back in the 1970s, I don't know, the Carter administration, had somebody said, every single person in America has got to carry a recording device that can listen in on their conversations and pinpoint their precise location at all times, and anyone found without such a device will be shot on sight. Well, people would have had a fit. We would have had a revolution. We would have had a civil war. Fast forward 30, 40 years, and now we actually have people not only carrying that exact device, but grinning about it, standing in line for hours as these new devices are released so they can get the best one, and paying $600-800 a pop for the privilege of carrying it. So if you're Stalin and you want to figure out how to surveil the populace, it's going to cost you a lot of money to figure out how to go door to door and pound in the doors of frightened people, kids hiding behind their mom's aprons and women cowering and men holding back to keep from being aggressive, and everybody's afraid as jackbooted thugs come in and put cameras and microphones in people's homes. And that would have cost a lot of money. It would have cost a lot of effort, and it would have created a populace that hated the government. But now today we have people paying hundreds of dollars to purchase drop cams from Google, which is a technology designed specifically to do exactly that. You can actually hang a camera in your own dining room and you yourself pay money to record the conversations that you have at the dining table and send them onto a server located at Google's distant location where they can peruse what's being said. And so rather than costing money and creating a political destabilization, which would have had to happen in the last century, in this century, you can create the exact same surveillance network, have people love you, and pay you for the privilege so you get rich too. So what's not to love if you're a tyrant about this new form of tyranny where you just convince people that they have to have the latest thing, and the latest thing is exactly what allows you to watch them.
Exactly. And, you know, speaking of the stuff that Google has been purchasing in the last 5 years or so, one of the major purchases they made was for Nest. Some people that are listening to this probably know what the Nest product is. It's a digital thermostat that you can replace your current thermostat with. And it's a smart, It's a smart thermostat in that it will allow you to have access to it from the internet so you can control it and do stuff, turn off on lights, off lights, turn on your appliances, whatever. And the Nest product, which is now owned by Google, of course, it knows your entire energy profile within your house. But even as concerning is that according to the Internet of Things, or the philosophy Internet of Things, Google Nest, the Nest product that sits on your wall right where your thermostat used to sit, can also be programmed to interact automatically with other devices attached to that same Internet of Things in your home, and even outside your home via the internet connection to a smartphone or some other, you know, utility company or whatever, that can reach in and set policies in place that will automatically control your environment without your knowledge.
Yes. So this is the ultimate form of control. In Austin, Texas, which is one of my biggest radio listening audiences, they actually, it's been several years now, probably 8 years now, since they came out with a free digital thermostat. So a lot of people have the old dial kind. In fact, I just had mine replaced, but not with a smart one, quote unquote. But what they did for landlords with apartment buildings who had large numbers of these thermostats is they offered a free thermostat program where if you lived in the city of Austin, they would come in and put a free digital thermostat worth $100 into your living space. And if you were a landlord, they'd put it into dozens or even hundreds of potential living spaces in your apartment buildings. And then in the event of an excessive use of electricity, let's say it's a really hot day and it's 110 degrees out and everybody's running their electricity, they can then send out a signal across the city of Austin, and everyone who has one of these thermostats is going to find their thermostat won't go below, let's say, 90 degrees on that given day, that their air conditioner simply won't go any colder than that. And that's the way that they look at reducing energy consumption on those occasions. The same goes for smart washers and dryers, smart toasters, smart appliances. The idea is that they would be able to reach in and say, you know, we've got a lot of factories and they're using a lot of electricity, and we need to free up the electricity for them because they're the big consumers of electricity anyway, is commerce, is the commercial sector. So we need to reach in and make sure that you cannot run your washer or dryer between the hours of, let's say, 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. It doesn't matter how many times you flip the switch, it's literally just not going to turn on if we send the signal out. So this is giving people an extraordinary amount of control over how your appliances function. And talking about Nest, I had another guest on my program who actually is a researcher who, I believe at a university in Australia. And what he did was actually analyze the signals that are being sent from the Nest appliances back to Google. And what he found is that Google didn't tell anybody this, but every single day, every 24-hour period, Google sends a huge block of information. It's encrypted, so nobody knows what it contains, but it sends this information from your home back to Google. And if you watch the online promotional videos for Nest, which are up on YouTube and elsewhere, you can actually see that the Nest thermostat, or excuse me, the Nest smoke alarms, not only are able to detect a fire and set off an alarm, but they actually serve as night lights, which means that they watch you walk around. They have motion sensors, so they know who is walking around at what time of the day or night. They know how many people are in the house based on how many people are walking by at a given time. And they send all of this information, presumably, back to Google. And Google loves to receive this information. information because Google is an information gathering company. And before we go too much further, I should mention that a number of years ago, I've been a privacy advocate for 15 years working on these things, and my very first website is up at nocards.org, fighting against supermarket frequent shopper cards, which are really purchase registration cards, but that's a whole other story. I have done probably 2,500 radio and television interviews, so I've done lots and lots of talking about this. And I remember one period back in probably 2008 when a woman listening to me called into the show and she said, "You know, Catherine, you really need to create a suicide hotline." And I said, "What? I'm not in that business. I'm a privacy advocate." She said, "No, when you tell us this information, it's so horrifying that we are terrified and we need somebody to talk to because it almost feels like it's just pointless to even try to fight against it and it's so discouraging." And so I took that to heart and I actually said to myself, you know, here I've been going for 8 years now warning people, but I haven't provided solutions. So in 2009, I actually made a switch and I began to focus my attention not so much on revealing what was wrong, but on solving the problems. And so I actually helped to create a private search engine that is an alternative to Google. That here's the thing with Google. Google gives you great search results, but its whole purpose is to be bait so it can suck in your personal information. So I helped to create StartPage at startpage.com, which is a private search engine that basically proxies Google for you. So when you go to StartPage, you type in whatever it is you want to search for, you know, your private information, your medical condition, or the fact that you need a marriage counselor, or you're concerned about drug addiction, whatever it might be, really personal stuff. And we then take that information and we submit that question to Google for you. We get the full Google search results. We strip out all the tracking cookies and other things that they would use to monitor you. We deliver those results to you privately at startpage.com, and then we delete all records of your visit, including your IP address. So at the end of the day, we don't even know who's been on our website, and we don't know what they've searched for. And all Google knows is that it got 6 million searches this particular day from who knows who at startpage.com, but they have no idea who those people are. So that was the first thing that I did, because once I realized what Google was doing, I swore I would never again use the Google search engine. And we radio hosts need to be really careful because we say Google this and Google that. I want to challenge you never to say that again, not that you do, but never say it again to all the listeners, because every time you say Google this, Google that, you're giving this company countless millions of dollars of free advertising. Google is not a verb. It's a big multinational information-sucking octopus, and we should not be using it as a verb. It sounds really cute. They've got nice little colors. All that has been psychologically determined and designed specifically to get you to feel comfortable so you will reveal your information to them, but they're not our friends. So I encourage everybody to stop using Google, remove Google.com from your computer, go to startpage.com. You will get the same search results without the surveillance. And then once we had that running for a couple of years, I realized that the other problem with Google is what I was talking about earlier, the email. That Gmail is designed specifically to get you to feel comfortable and put your email onto their servers behind where they can see it, they can get access to it, and they read every single message without exception. So if you talk in an email about your vacation plans or your opposition to a particular political candidate or your concerns about your health, Google is capturing that and making money off of it.
Let me ask a question. Let's just intercede here for a second, Catherine. The terms of use with Gmail, actually, that's the one that nobody reads, right, when they set up an account.
Right.
Because who reads these pages anyway? But the actual terms of use, when you sign that, click, I agree, you actually are giving them the authority. You're telling them specifically that they have the authority to read anything in your email. That basically anything there becomes their property. Is that correct?
Correct. That is correct. And in fact, back in 2004, I and 20 other privacy experts and organizations, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Electronic Privacy Information Center at epic.org, Privacy International, the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, the ACLU, we all got together And we wrote a letter in 2004 to Google saying, you have this idea for this new thing called Gmail. And what you're doing is you're taking the existing email system, which back then, remember, we had Earthlink and Netcom and AOL, and all of those services, including even Hotmail, which is still around today, all of those services promise you the same degree of privacy that the Postal Service promises you when you mail a sealed envelope, that they promise to deliver your email but never read it. And so what Google came up with was they said, it's really great that we have all this information flowing in from this window that tells us everything everybody's thinking all day long, but we really want to know what they're saying to each other, and we can't hack into their email, so how are we going to get it? And they came up with this idea to determine the pain point with existing email programs and figure out how to solve it so that their email would become so appealing that everybody would switch all of the contents of their email over to them where they could read it. And what they figured out, and if you remember back to prior to 2004, the big problem with email was you were always running out of space, right? You'd log on and it would say, your email account is full. Please delete messages so you can receive new ones. Or you'd write to somebody else and it'd say, your mail wasn't delivered because this person's box is full. It was really annoying. So Google at that time in 2004 came out with the idea that they were going to lure everybody over to their service by offering a gigabyte of storage space, and everybody switched. And we sent out a letter and we said, if you do this, if you actually lure people over to Gmail and have this new, totally new, unprecedented, never before seen policy of actually reading people's email, then first of all, that's horrifying and you shouldn't do it. But second of all, you're going to change the way email is done because other people are going to follow your lead. And sure enough, they ignored our letter. They issued Gmail. It's now the number one email provider in America. And they sure enough did lead the charge because now everybody from Hotmail to Yahoo to you name it is reading your email. They all capitulated and gave in to this new system. What we didn't realize in 2004 when we wrote that letter is that not only was that going to change the way email was done, but that was going to change the way the entire internet and all the apps on your phone, which didn't even exist then, how all of that stuff is funded. Because now the model is no matter what you get for free on the internet or whatever app you get for free on your phone, you are always providing massive amounts of personal information in exchange for it. I'll give you an example, MailChimp.com, which manages people's mailing lists. Actually, if you look at the other side of MailChimp, not the free service that will manage your mailing list, but the other side, which is their research services, they say, we can tell you exactly what the cross linkage is between people who are on this kind of mailing list, maybe interested in fly fishing, and this other kind of mailing list where there may be Republicans supporting Rand Paul. They know everything because they read the contents of the emails that they manage through their mailing list, and they closely look at all the email addresses of all those individuals. So if you're using MailChimp to manage your mailing list, it might be free, but you're giving them your entire mailing list. You're giving them private confidential email addresses of individuals and letting them know and letting this company know what those individuals are interested in so they can cross-reference it with other things those people are doing. So that's just one example, and it's one of thousands of examples that literally every single thing on the internet that is so-called free now is no longer funded by advertisements. Remember in the old days they used to just put an ad on the page and you'd look at the ad and that's how they paid for it. Nowadays they pay for it by sucking up your private information. And Google was the company that pioneered that concept back in 2004. So back to our solution, I actually work with the team at startpage.com, which is based in the Netherlands, based in Europe. It's a wonderful company. It's family-owned. I know all the people. We've broken bread and had meals together. I've known them for over 6 years. And 4 years ago, I said to them, listen, we've solved the problem of the search engine. No longer do people have to Google it. They can now start page it. But there's a problem with people's email, and we need to create email that is private. And so we spent literally 3 years building an email program from scratch, from the ground up, to incorporate all of the Ed Snowden revelations and all of the latest technology for protecting people's privacy. And it's called StartMail. It's at startmail.com. And you can watch a video I put together, which kind of explains what it does. But what we've basically done is created an email program where not only do we not read your email, but we allow you to encrypt it using almost military-grade encryption so that nobody else can read it either, not your ISP, not your friend's email service, not the NSA, if they're monitoring you, nobody can read it, and we can't read it either. So it's one click. We use PGP encryption, which has been around for many years, but has been really hard for people to use. Took me 6 months to learn back in 2000, and then I couldn't find anybody else to do it with me, so I stopped using it. But now we've got it so easy that your six-year-old granddaughter or, you know, your clueless cousin in Des Moines can use this program and literally click the button that says encrypt this email, and they will have military-grade privacy on their email. So that's at startmail.com, and I'm super excited because I believe that between just these two tools, we will eliminate probably about 75% of the data flowing into the hands of these huge corporations on the Internet. And then the next step is to figure out just how to say no to all the stuff flowing into our homes.
Exactly. There's another, this is really good. I didn't anticipate the direction it would take, but I'll tell you, people want solutions to this. They really do. And I get asked all the time, you know, what can we do? How can we kind of drop off the grid, so to speak? Well, the fact is you can't drop off the grid entirely. But that doesn't mean you have to give everything but your kitchen sink to,
right,
to companies like Google either. So securing your email, securing your search patterns, that's something that's a big one. That's just a big gimme. You're just giving away everything that's in your head, and you can stop that right now. I know there's a small fee for Start Mail, but there isn't for Start Page.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because when I send a piece of mail through the Postal Service, I actually pay 50 cents for a stamp to send that first class and have it go through the mail.
Right.
When you send an email, though, the expectation is that it's going to be totally free, which means somebody's going to be reading it, which means somebody's going to be storing and cataloging all of the things that you say. So when I told our team, let's develop Start Mail, they said, well, are people really going to be willing to pay for it? And I took a gamble, and I said, yes, I believe they will. I believe people are willing to pay for it, and we calculated out what it would cost us to run the program and still be able to pay the engineers so they can feed their families, and it worked out to $5 a month to be able to do private email. And $5 a month, we actually now are running a special, which I'll tell you about. If you use the coupon code, and I realize people are going to be hearing this interview from years to come, so I'll give you one coupon code and a place to get another one. If it is 2015 when you're hearing this interview, you can use the coupon code 2015 at startmail.com to save $5 off and get two free accounts with your account. So you will, for $54.95, which is $5 a month minus $5, you will get a one-year StartMail account and two free companion accounts for your friends. And so what you want to do is you sign up at startmail.com, you give the coupon code 2015, and then you take those two accounts and you give them to the people that you write to the most. So let's say that's your spouse, your best friend, your business partner, your attorney, your mom, whoever that might be. Give those two accounts to them. Take the time to learn how to actually set everything up. It'll take you about 10 minutes, and you'll all be set. And then you can immediately begin writing encrypted private email to one another that nobody can read. And that it when I say encrypted private email, it's literally you check the box that says encrypt this message. That's all you do, and it's that simple. It works out to, with the three accounts, $1.67 per month per account, and you probably pay more than that for a cup of coffee at your local Dunkin' Donuts or Winchell's, because you can't even get coffee for $1.67 nowadays. So when I actually promised my team, if we build it, they will come, that people would actually be willing to pay for privacy. And the really good news is that it's actually proven true. We just hit the 10,000 subscriber mark, so we have 10,000 paid subscribers at $60 a year. We're just 1 year out of the gate, and we're refining our product and making it better every day. We've had tremendously positive reviews. We've had Bruce Schneier, the security expert, go over it with a fine-tooth comb. He gave us a glowing thumbs up. We had Ladar Levison of LavaBit, who had to shut down his email service because of Ed Snowden being on his account. Ladar Levison, we're also working with him, who also is a huge supporter. We've just gotten really positive feedback. It is the most secure email you can obtain anywhere, but it's also super, super easy to use, and I stand behind it. So I really believe in it. And I told you I was going to give you another coupon code. If it is not 2015 when you're hearing this, if it's 2016, 17, 18, 19, 20, some other year, then go to my website at KatherineAlbrecht.com or just my name, KMAshow.com, and there will be a coupon code on my homepage that you can use. So it's KMAshow.com. And there will be a coupon code pretty much from now until forever. So I will always provide one on there for people to use because I really want people to take back their privacy. Everybody says it can't be done. It's impossible. They're always watching. It's just not true. There are things that you can do. And it may take kind of getting used to a newer system. But heavens, I mean, think about how much you pay for curtains. Right? If you live on the ground floor and you're in a city and people are walking by on the sidewalk, you're going to go to the store and you're going to pay probably $60 for curtains to hang in your front window. And so we do certain things for privacy, but when it comes to email, these companies have brainwashed into thinking that we can't have privacy and we shouldn't pay for privacy. It's kind of as though Google brainwashed you into thinking that all of your windows should be wide open and you should have searchlights aimed at yourself when you walk around the bedroom.
Mm-hmm. This is a mindset that you don't have to be a victim. And we're just describing easy things that can be done, low-hanging fruit that can be done to close some of the gaps of private information going out. There's two more big holes that I addressed in an article from last August that was entitled "You Can Beat Government Hacker Surveillance." We're talking about this exact thing. In that article, actually, I mentioned Start Page and also Start Mail. But the other two big holes in communication is in telephone and in chat sessions on your phones, like on your smartphone, for instance. And there are some really, really good solutions to make those devices more secure. I use an application myself personally called Signal. It only works on iPhone and Android phones. It's free, doesn't cost anything. They're a user-supported organization. This is the only chat application, by the way, that's endorsed by Ed Snowden himself. And it uses high-level encryption to cloak everything that you chat, all your chat sessions back and forth, including pictures and whatever that you might put into it. They're all encrypted. They're delivered end-to-end, and the messages are never stored on a central server anywhere. That's their pledge, at least. And the other thing that's really interesting about Signal is that they've just added phone calls into the service, where if you call another user using Signal, your voice call is encrypted end-to-end. It kind of reminds you of the old spy boxes back. I'm thinking like the Get Smart TV series. Once upon a
right.
time, they'd put this little device over the microphone on the old handset, and it would garble your voice to where you couldn't understand it unless somebody on the other end had that same box, you know, to put into the speaker
right.
side. So encrypted phone calls is also very useful if you don't want somebody else to hear what you're saying. Then this is what you can do. And, you know, this is kind of a solution that goes back to part of what Google is doing with this phone call service. It's great. You know, it's a very convenient service that they have, but they are able to transcribe your entire phone conversation, save it to a text file, and analyze it any way they want to analyze it after that to find
well,
out exactly what you said.
Just to clarify on that, Google Voice, which is the Google phone service,
yeah.
is a horrible privacy invasion. And the reason they've made it available is so that they can get you saying, you know how it says, please state your voice at the tone and Google Voice will connect you.
Right.
The reason they do that is because they want to know, first of all, who called who, so they know the number that originated from and the number they called. They also want to know the name of the caller because anyone could be calling from a particular number, but if you give your name, then they know that. And they also want to link up a voice print with that particular phone number and that particular individual's name. So as a result, Google has created an enormous, immense catalog of not fingerprints of Americans, but voice prints of Americans because we use this Google Voice service. So when I call a number and it says, please state your name at the tone and Google Voice, we'll try to connect you, I just sit there silently. I don't say a word because Google is listening to that. Now, once the connection is made, once you actually connect to the other party, it is my understanding, and it is Google's policy, that they do not listen to your conversation beyond that. But we really have no way of knowing how much they have the capability of listening to. If they had a warrant or if they had a rogue employee or simply an NSA backdoor, could they listen to that conversation? And that's a big question mark. What they are able to do and what they do acknowledge doing is that if you call a Google Voice subscriber and you leave a voicemail, then they will get your name, your phone number, the time you called, and an entire transcript of the voicemail that you left. So I tell people, be really careful with Greek-sparing gifts, or in this case, geeks-sparing gifts. Anytime a technology company offers you something and it seems too good to be true and it's free, you got to ask yourself, you got to tell yourself, there is a catch. Absolutely, there is a catch. And what is it? And the other thing we should probably talk about briefly is apps, apps on your phone. So I don't have a smartphone. I had one briefly, and I just felt creeped out by it. So I have a dumb phone that just makes phone calls, and that's pretty much it. But if you have a smartphone, I'll tell you the story of why I don't have a smartphone. So I was in Texas, and I was actually working with Andrea Hernandez, who is the 15-year-old student who said no to RFID tags around the students' necks at the John Jay High School there in San Antonio, Texas, which was really a horrible, horrible experience. And so I was down there, and I was interviewing people related to this, and I had my new smartphone, and I thought, wow, this smartphone probably has a recording device on it, so I can record instead of having a tape recorder. I could actually use my phone to record to record interviews. And so I sat in a Whole Foods, I remember this very well, in a little table by the window, with somebody I was going to interview. And I said, hang on a sec, I just need to install an app on my phone. So I went to the App Store, and I found all these free apps that would allow me to use my phone to make a recorded file. And my husband had cautioned me when I first got this phone. I'd maybe had it a week. He said, make sure that before you install any apps, you read the terms of service, because there's a lot of them that are nasty. And so the first app I had, I read the terms of service until I got to this line. When you install our service, you give us the right to copy your entire address book with all of your contact information. And I said, wait a minute, my address book has the phone numbers of people whose numbers are unlisted. That's really private information. And plus, it's nobody's business who my friends are. That's creepy. So I said, no. So I pulled up the second free app, same deal. The third free app had that, and it said, we will monitor all of your locations through the GPS tracking in your phone, which will be sent to us on a daily basis so we can monitor every single place you go. And I said, you got to be kidding me. All I want is the ability to record an interview, a 10-minute interview here in this Whole Foods, and instead I'm going to be giving over control of my entire phone to strangers. Long story short, I sat in that Whole Foods for probably 40 minutes. This poor person I was going to interview was so frustrated. And I said, I'm sorry, I cannot find a single app that I can install on my phone to do this interview that will not invade my privacy. And it was when I got back home to New Hampshire that I sent the phone back. I said, that's it, I don't want this phone. So I need to caution people, that's what the apps that are free are doing. If you don't read the terms of service, then you're pretty much a sitting duck for them to monitor you however they see fit. And when I give my phone number to people, my unlisted phone number, I say, whatever you do, just write it on a scrap of paper, stick it on your fridge, but don't put it in your phone, because any information about me that you put in your phone, if you don't have good privacy hygiene and you're sharing all your contact information, then my unlisted phone number is, surprise, suddenly no longer unlisted. So I tell people to be very careful what they do with my information on their devices, because I can't trust them to use them wisely.
That's exactly right. The issue with the program that I use for chat stuff on my phone currently, called Signal, It has really good encryption and stuff, but it does save the messages on your phone, and they don't automatically expire. They just sit there until you physically delete them yourself.
Do they have a copy of them? That's the big question.
No, they do not have a copy. They specifically say in the terms of service that they do not save a copy anywhere along the way. It's strictly end-to-end communication. There, nothing ever gets saved at all. There's right. there's another app that I have installed. I don't use it very much because, honestly, it's a bit of a pain to use it, but it has its use. It's the same kind of service as Signal. It's called Wickr, W-I-C-K-R. And it does end-to-end messaging, but you can assign an automatic blow update, if you will, on that message, on that chat message that you send, whether it's a picture or anything else. You can say that you can flag any amount of time. You can say 24 hours, it disappears and goes poof. You can say 15 minutes and it disappears and goes poof after you send it.
Well, that's great.
Which is really interesting. That's just another level. But the problem with these phones now is, if you get stopped by a policeman or, you know, somebody with national intelligence, even worse, and they ask for your cell phone and actually get it, then everything on your cell phone is sucked out and you lose it anyway. So
right.
there's still some risk about just keeping data on your cell phone, even if you know it's secure from everybody else. If they get a hold, and of course, it's the same thing with the computer. If they come in with a search warrant, grab your computer, and all of a sudden they have everything that's on your computer, including your
right.
passwords and blah, all that kind of stuff.
This is why you don't want to store things in the cloud, by the way, so they're on your physical devices. My computer laptop is actually encrypted, so
yes.
if I heard pam, pam, pound on my door, the first thing I would do is probably unplug or turn off my computer.
Right.
And
right.
that means that it would reset to a default state of encrypted, which they'll never be able to get into. And just to, if I could give your listeners just a sense of encryption, it's so powerful that the way I describe it is, imagine I wrote you a message, and then I put it through a confetti shredder. So now it's thousands of little pieces of confetti. And now I mix it with other confettis with words on them, and I stir them all up with enough other pieces of confetti with words on them to fill the Grand Canyon. So now imagine your 1,000 pieces of my message mixed in with an unimaginable quantity of other messages, and now multiply that by 100 Grand Canyons full of messages, and my little shreds are mixed in with other identical little shreds in that mess. There's no way that the NSA, even with supercomputers, is going to be able to figure that out. The estimate is it would take 40 years for them to decrypt a single message. So the more of us that use encryption, if we actually start encrypting all of our messages, even the ones that say, hey, have a happy Thanksgiving, you know, hey, Pat, it was great doing that interview, then for them to be able to decrypt all those messages would be an absolutely impossible task. And that's why it's really important to be using encryption and to make it the default so that everybody is using encryption. And at that point, they're going to have no way to be able to figure out all this information. It's really important, not just for things that are private, but for everything. So it doesn't say, ooh, 99% of his email is not encrypted, but this one is, so maybe that's the target we need to go after. I encrypt all my email whenever I can, so that, you know, if I send a message to my husband and it says, hey, we're having chicken for dinner, that's an encrypted message.
Yeah.
And it's really important that we do that for everything. And I want to put in a plug for an expensive tool called a black phone. And the black phone, when you're talking about this, you know, people getting a hold of your phone, the black phone is protected on the physical hardware level. Every single app on it is protected. A black phone conversation is encrypted. The texts are encrypted. The web surfing is encrypted. Everything on that phone is encrypted. And it was actually created by a team from my friend Ladar Levison from Lababit, who was working with Ed Snowden, that he and Phil Zimmerman, the creator of PGP encryption, have been working together on this. And it's extraordinary. So if you can afford it, check it out. It's black phone. I think it's .ch because they're over in Switzerland right now. But it's absolutely all the things you talk about, but it's already built into the phone. So it's if you can afford it and you want to go high tech, it's probably the way to go. Mm. And in the meantime, startpage.com, totally free. Make it your new homepage, your new search engine. Don't use Google. Don't say Google it. Say startpage it, and people go, what do you mean? And you can explain it and have a teachable moment. Startmail should be managing all of your emails so that you never again send an open book message that marketers and government are capturing. That's startmail.com. And then the tools that you talked about are excellent ways to protect yourself. So protect your chats. And probably the big battle in the future is going to be, don't bring this stuff into your home. Don't ever buy an appliance that calls itself smart. Don't ever buy a TV that's watching you. Don't ever buy a refrigerator that's hooked up to the internet. If it's connected to the internet, it's watching you. If it's smart, quote unquote, it's watching you, and you don't want it. And I would say the final piece of this is, don't let this thing, this entity that we're building, into your body. And I've written a book. I know that you're a Christian, and I know that many listeners are Christian. The Bible actually talks about this time coming. It talks about a time when you won't be able to buy or sell without a mark on or in your body, on your right hand or your forehead, a time when you won't be able to buy or sell without a number. And people are already doing that. They're buying and selling with credit cards and PayPal accounts and Bitcoins. The next step of this is to put it in the body. In Sweden, there's actually an office building where people have taken microchips implanted into their flesh in order to pay for the vending machine and the photocopier and turn on their computers. So they're literally buying and selling with a number inside their body. And in Revelation, the last book of the Bible, chapter 13, kind of an unlucky number there, Revelation 13, the last three verses, 16 through 18, talk about a time when all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and bond or enslaved or imprisoned, will be caused to receive a mark on their right hand or their forehead, and they will have to have that to buy or sell. And that is the mark of the beast. The Christians have been looking out for it for 2,000 years. I would argue that we are like one heartbeat away from it actually being here. We have the ability to put payment devices in people. There's a guy in Denmark who put a microchip in his right hand, which contains his Bitcoin numbers, so digital cash, and he claims that he's the first person who can buy and sell with a chip in his right hand. So we're right on the cusp of what Christians have long warned about. The churches aren't talking about it. The media is not talking about it. Nobody's talking about Christian prophecy, as you've pointed out in your great book, Technocracy Rising. It's almost as though the churches have fallen asleep, and I think it's no coincidence that they've fallen asleep on this information right as it comes to pass. So I've written a book, so those of us who are old enough to remember how Lindsay and other people cautioning us about biblical prophecy and the mark of the beast from the 1970s, so that we can pass that information on to our children and our grandchildren's generation, because the churches and nobody else are doing it. And I've written a book called I Won't Take the Mark. It's online at virtuepress.com, I Won't Take the Mark. It's a children's book, but it's also great for adults. Using the King James Bible in Scripture, beautifully illustrated on archival, gorgeous paper. It's a lush, beautiful book. And it basically explains the book of Revelation for kids, the prophecy about the mark of the beast, tells them what to look out for and what to say no to, because this is really critical. Our generation may not be here when this stuff actually comes and our descendants are asked to take the mark of the beast. And if they haven't been warned, they won't know to say no. I'm shocked at how many young people, and I would challenge everybody in the listening audience, ask the young people you know, if they know not to take the mark of the beast. And the chances are, even if they've gone to Sunday school every Sunday and vacation Bible school, they'll look at you and say, I don't know what that is. It's really shocking that an entire generation of Christian young people is being raised without a knowledge of the biggest threat they face based on today's technology and the warnings of the Bible from 2,000 years ago. So if you go to virtuepress.com, you can actually look inside the book. You can flip through the pages and check it out. But the book is not the real point. The real point is the certificate that goes with the book, because it is actually a place where the child can make a promise to you as the adult in their life never to take the mark of the beast. It's got a beautifully illustrated 8x10 certificate that we've got beautiful matching frames that go in it. It's a whole gift package for less than $100. And we've got wrapping paper, Christmas paper, birthday paper, gift cards, you name it. So you can log on to the website less than $100. You can give this beautiful gift of a frame, an 8x10 certificate promising never to take the mark of the beast, never to worship anyone but God, and to call on Jesus Christ to help them keep their promise. It's got a sinner's prayer in the back of the book if they've not yet accepted Jesus as their Savior. There's a perfect opportunity to do that in the book. And my hope, my prayer, is that millions of children, I mean, I'd love to see, we gave away copies to every child in the island nation of Anguilla. We literally gave them for free last year. So my hope is that every child on earth who has Christian parents or grandparents will actually take this pledge to heart, take this 8x10 certificate, put it on their wall, so as they get dressed in the morning and go to bed at night, it's not just a book they read once, but it's something they look at every single day. And in 30, 50, 100 years, whenever it happens that they or their descendants are called upon to take the mark of the beast, they will know to say no. So that's been my life's work. Aside from all this privacy work, that's really what the Lord's put on my heart to do. It's taken 15 years to get the book and the certificate and the frames together, but they're at virtuepress.com. It makes a wonderful gift, and I encourage people to head over and give the most important gift of all. If you give them a video game or a toy or a doll, they're going to outgrow it, forget about it. That'll be the end. You know, throw it away in a couple of months when it breaks. But this is the gift of eternity. It's literally the gift of a relationship with Jesus Christ and a warning about the most important issue that we face. So I think it's the most important gift a parent or grandparent can give to their child. And that's why I created it.
That sounds like an excellent resource. One last thing I'd like to close on, and this is maybe just an aside, but you'll never hear from Google a report or somebody coming out making a criticism against Google. You'll never hear from Google that there are, you know, scores of databases within the Google system that are vulnerable to attack. You just don't see news stories appear that, oh, Google got hacked last week and they lost, you know, 80 gajillion records on something. It's interesting they know how to secure their stuff. But the Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department just last week released a report that stated that Homeland Security itself is running hundreds of top secret databases that are vulnerable to attacks. This was the Inspector General that said this. And of course, we've heard about attacks, you know, coming against the Department of Defense and the Social Security Administration and all these others that, you know, you wonder how come they can't keep their data secure, but companies like Google and Yahoo and so on, they keep everything pretty much secure, but the government can't. But maybe they actually don't, you see, and they just never hear about it.
We have just one example of this out of China, which is that someone used social engineering to get into all of the Gmail accounts held in China. And so hackers were able to actually compromise those accounts. We believe that those hackers were members of the Chinese military and the government, because what happened to the people whose accounts were compromised is that dissidents, because of things they'd written in their supposedly private Gmail accounts, were rounded up and sent into labor camps, and many of them were tortured because of information that they'd written about through their Gmail, which was compromised by the government and used against them. Wow. So that's a direct example of it not being secure. And, you know, Google was, we know about this because Google said, oh, yeah, those bad Chinese. But the reality is that if you read No Place to Hide by Glenn Greenwald and you look at the information that Ed Snowden has revealed, we know that the NSA, our own government, has built a backdoor into Google and into Gmail and into those accounts. So here we all are all worried that the Chinese government can do this when we have evidence that our own government can do it and has done it.
So the bottom line is, don't let it get in there in the first place, and then you won't have to worry about it being hacked by everybody and his brother.
That's right. Oh, and I should mention one more thing, which I love about StartMail that we built into StartMail, is let's say you want to write a sensitive email, or even just a happy Thanksgiving, or have Merry Christmas, or happy birthday, happy Easter, to another person, and that person has a Gmail account. So, obviously, anything you write to that person is going to be in the hands of Gmail, right? Well, wrong, because we've created this awesome system within StartMail where you can write to anybody no matter how compromised their email is, and instead of the message landing in their Gmail box, it actually lands, we create sort of a mini mailbox on our servers in Europe that is encrypted that we can't read. And it's a place where you and that person can correspond. You can actually write back and forth to each other for months in this little mini mailbox that we create for you two that there's no access to by Gmail or anybody else. So basically you send them a message and it says, hey, your Gmail account saying, hey, there's a private encrypted message waiting for you. And if you can answer this security question and provide the password, then you can get to it. And of course, Google's not going to have the password. And then you log on to our SSL encrypted server, and you read the message and you reply to it there. And, so we thought of pretty much everything.
Yeah. And to Google, you say, as you do that, you say, neener, neener.
Yes. I just want to put it in there, yes.
Exactly. That's great. Well, hey, listen, I don't want to take up any more of your time, Catherine. This has been a great time together, and I think people not only will get a lot of new knowledge out of this, but also solutions, and I like solutions. I think everybody else likes solutions as well. You don't have to be a victim. There's a lot of scary stuff out there when you look at all the surveillance that's going on, and not just that, but the reasons why people are doing this is very, very disconcerting. But you don't have to be a victim. There's a lot of stuff you can do to protect yourself. It's kind of like playing a trombone. It slides in, it slides out. You can raise your security level up. You probably can't ever get to 100% unless you want to go live under a bridge somewhere out in the desert and just, you know, be a homeless guy, I guess. But you can do a lot of things that will take away the low-hanging fruit from these people. And you can stop the outflow of personal data on yourself by just practicing some common sense things and also getting some of these secure apps that will encrypt things and keep it away from prying eyes. I think that's really the key. And it's not an all or nothing deal. You don't have to go out today and sign up for 6 new things. You know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to just do it all today. You've already been exposed for so long anyway. Start out and do one thing a week and do it well. You know, if you get a Start Mail account or if you get a start using Start Page, get it installed. Learn how to use it as you go so that you're not just overwhelmed with all this new stuff. And you know what? Over a period of a month, if you have an action plan to do this, you will end up at the end of a month, you'll end up to where you're 80% secure, whereas before you were 100% insecure.
Isn't that great? I know. And it's not overwhelming. We've actually really gone out of our way to make it easy to do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's amazing how connected people are to those Google colors, to that Google name. You know, it's like Google, like teddy bear. It's cute. But we've got to recognize that company is a, I don't know, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing, and we've got to get away from them. So startpage.com. And by the way, when you go to Startpage, you'll see it says powered by Google, but that doesn't mean we give them any information. That just means we have actual Google results that we give you, but Google sees nothing. Mm-hmm. We share nothing with them whatsoever, literally zero.
Right.
So don't worry about that part. And then StartMail, just once again, that coupon code to save $5 is 2015. And if it is not 2015 when you hear this interview, head on over to my website at kmashow.com, and while you're there, you can check out my radio show and 8 years worth of archived programs on there. So check it all out, and I want to thank you so much for Technocracy Rising, which is an extraordinary book, Pat, and thanks for this opportunity. It's just been really great to talk about all of this.
Absolutely. Catherine, you've had a long, long history on this. I know we've made some progress. We haven't arrived yet, but we've made a lot of progress. And the most important thing is there's enough progress to say that nobody has to be caught up in this web completely. Nobody does. And that there's lots of things that you can do if people want to put their attention to it and work on. And they should. They should spread the word, tell their friends and neighbors, whatever. Get on these alternative systems. Get away from the big institutional systems. And they will find that they will deny the beast, so to speak. Everything of a private nature. So this has been great, Catherine. I really appreciate your time. You've given us just a boatload of information. I'm sure people are going to be wildly interested to hear what you have to say. And I hope we can do this again sometime. So, maybe in another couple of months or whatever, we can get back at it, do a follow-up interview, and just see where it all went.
Thank you. Absolutely. Be delighted to. And God bless you and your listeners. Thanks so much.
Thank you. This is Patrick Wood, again, the host of the Technocracy News Hour. We'll be back again with another great program next week.